In the last 8 years, more than 10,000 bills in state houses across the country were copied and pasted from special interest groups. Illinois passed more of these bills into law than any other state. Plus, Purdue University is limiting streaming to websites like Hulu and Netflix during classes. Will it get more students to pay attention? But first, more than 150 people in Illinois have been hit by a drug-resistant fungus. The new Illinois Director of Public Health joins us to talk about that and more.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's April 15th. It's tax day. I hope you've gotten all of that done and squared away. Coming up this hour, we're going to be talking about cut and paste legislation written by special interest groups. One investigation has found Illinois passes more of these types of laws than any other state in the country. And Purdue University, just next door, is throttling streaming services during classes. Will this keep students from watching Netflix and Hulu while they're in class? We're going to talk about technology in the college classroom. But first, you may have heard about a rare but potentially life-threatening fungus that has infected more than 150 people in Illinois. In fact, while it is rare, Illinois has experienced the most cases in the country behind New York. It's called Candida auris, and as we'll hear more about in a moment, what makes it so potentially deadly is that it's often resistant to drug treatment. We want to be clear that the majority of our state has not seen any of these cases of this happening. By far, most of the cases have been in and around Chicago. There have also been three reported cases in St. Louis. Joining me now to explain more about what this fungus is and whether healthy people need to be concerned about it is the new director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, Dr. Ngozi Ezike. Dr. Rachel Rubin is also with us from the Cook County Department of Public Health. Doctors, good morning. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Good morning, and thank you for having us.
Dr. Ezike, I wonder if we can start with the basics. Can you just explain exactly what is Candida auris?
Right. So Candida auris is a fungus that can cause serious infections, is often resistant to medications, and is being seen to spread in healthcare settings. Overall, you could still say it's rare in the United States, and of course, it's very important that most people are at very low risk of infection.
And when you say most people, you mean by the people who are most at risk of infection are, I imagine, are most vulnerable when it comes to a health population?
Exactly. The people who are at high risk are people who have multiple medical conditions already, who may have who may require ventilator assistance, who have G-tubes. So our sickest or immunocompromised people are the people who are most at risk of infection.
Dr. Rubin, how are we seeing this fungus spread?
It's spread on surfaces. So it tends to colonize the skin. So what that means is that a healthcare provider or potentially a family member will touch a patient or their loved one and then touch a surface like a bedside table and walk out of the room and then somebody else and then go into another room and touch another patient or even wash their hands but then somebody comes in and touches that surface. Because it can live on surfaces for as much as 30 days. And so it's very, very easily spread by surfaces becoming colonized with the organism.
And I imagine, Dr. Rubin, part of the problem with this is it something where if a surface is sterilized or treated, does that take care of the fungus, or how does that work?
Yes, generally speaking, if it is cleaned with the appropriate cleaning solutions, it can be eradicated. But what's interesting is people don't even think about all the surfaces that they touch, even healthcare workers, when they go into a patient's room or living space. But it can be eradicated with appropriate cleaning solutions, and there have been specified cleaning solutions that will eradicate the organism. Not every cleaning solution will work.
Dr. Izike, where are we seeing these cases in Illinois? I mentioned primarily in the Chicago area and within Cook County, but we've seen a few isolated cases in a couple of other counties as well.
Right. So it's really been, like you said, Chicago, Cook County, and then the collar counties. Those are the areas that have been hit in Illinois.
And we first saw this enter Illinois in 2016. Do we know, or are we able to track how it got here, Dr. Izike?
No, we can't say that. We know that it was first discovered in 2009, and it's been found to cause infections in more than 30 countries. We did not see it here, again, as you correctly stated, until spring of 2016.
Dr. Rubin, I wonder if we can talk just a little bit about just how you mentioned this as a fungus that infects the skin. Is it noticeable then? At one point, does it become serious? Because obviously, part of the reason people are concerned by this is if it could possibly be life-threatening.
Correct. When it's just on the skin, it's not noticeable. People will be, as we say, colonized with it and not know they have it on their skin. But when it becomes, creates an illness predominantly, is when it becomes, it infects your bloodstream. So it's usually, as Dr. Izike mentioned, when somebody is immunocompromised. So their underlying health is not good, and they have multiple medical problems such that they become susceptible and they're not able to ward off infection. So the fungus then it basically can enter your body, whether it's through your mouth or through a sore on the skin, and then it gets into your bloodstream, and then it causes a systemic bloodborne infection, and that's when it becomes life-threatening.
And why is it so difficult to treat, Dr. Rubin?
Not all of the strains, but many of the strains of the organism are resistant to most of the antifungal agents that we have. There are only a few antifungal agents that even exist, and the organism can become resistant to the antibiotic, or not the antibiotic, the antifungal agent. So that's one of the main reasons that it's very, very hard to treat once somebody has a systemic infection from it. The other is, too, is that even if they are on an antifungal agent that potentially can eradicate the organism, if they are already so ill because of other underlying problems, they may not be able to ward off the infection despite treatment.
Mm-hmm. And when we're thinking about this, I think people are very familiar with antibiotics and obviously things like penicillin, Dr. Rubin. But what about antifungals? Like, is that a particular class of drugs that we have a lot of, or we know a lot about? I'm thinking in terms of the general public.
Yeah, you know, for the general public's purpose, there's antifungal agents, there's antiviral agents, there are antibacterial agents, and the antibacterial agents are the ones that we generally call antibiotics. However, they all are basically function to ward off particular types of infections. So an antifungal agent is really no different in terms of how we use it than the way we would use an antibiotic. You can't just use one antibiotic for any kind of infection. The same thing with any of these agents. They're specific for certain kinds of organisms.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Izike, I wonder, as we're thinking about this in particular, if you think the average healthy listener who's listening to this conversation, is this something they should be concerned about?
Well, I understand that people are concerned when they hear that there's a bug that potentially is deadly. Again, most people are not at risk. It is the people who are severely ill, have comorbidities, are immunocompromised, are on ventilators, have, you know, indwelling tubes or central lines. Those are the people that are most at risk. But I still would recommend to everyone just to employ hand hygiene techniques whenever they can. Like, we all want to keep ourselves as healthy as possible by just maintaining, you know, good hand hygiene practices.
And I wanted to ask both of you about that, because part of the thing, I think people thinking about this are thinking about, oh, if this is resistant to antifungal medications, we've all heard about superbugs that are resistant to antibiotics. And I think people who pay a little bit of attention to this are sometimes concerned about using too much hand sanitizer and things like that. Have we created too sterile of environment? I wanted to just ask both of you, when you're thinking about hand hygiene, do you think like soap and water is okay? What are you all thinking on that front, Dr. Ezike?
Right. So we do know that our alcohol-based hand rubs are effective. They are very effective in clearing our hands of this fungus. So we do recommend that. In this case, it may be more effective than hand washing, but in general, good hygiene practices, being aware of touching too many surfaces, we have to kind of guard, you know, be on guard with that. And if you do touch a bunch of different surfaces, to again keep practicing your hand hygiene techniques. But that is required in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rubin, as we've been talking about, the majority of these cases have been in and around Chicago. I wonder, other than being on alert, is there you all implementing anything different in Cook County that you can share with us?
I wouldn't say anything different, but in Cook County, the city of Chicago through the Chicago Department of Public Health, and then in the suburbs through my agency, we have for the last year and a half have been working very, very closely with long-term care facilities on appropriate hygienic practices and trying to control for C. auris, as well as other drug-resistant organisms that exist in long-term care facilities. So we've been working very hard with a very intensive training program, working very closely with partners who are work in these facilities.
And Dr. Rubin, is most of your concern in long-term care facilities versus hospitals, particularly when we're thinking about who's more vulnerable in these situations?
Yes, the vast majority of the cases that we have seen have been individuals that have been residents in long-term care facilities or in long-term care acute care hospitals. So these are not people that are in a regular hospital where they're there for a few days. It's where you go afterwards once you're discharged, whether it's to a nursing home or to an acute care hospital setting where you need more long-term care but with a high level of nursing support.
Dr. Ezike, when we're thinking about broad takeaways for people throughout the state, I wonder what we should be thinking about more when we're thinking about preventing future outbreaks.
Right. So, again, I think we should always just be thinking about the same things we've just been saying in terms of hand hygiene. If people have specific questions, you know, always, you know, I think your first line would be to contact, you know, your physician if you have specific concerns. I think it's really important just to highlight what we are doing with IDPH and, of course, you know, the other local health departments. You know, we are clinically, you know, constantly surveilling, you know, different locations. We are going into hospitals and checking. We're doing deep investigations of every single case. We're sending out multiple alerts to providers and hospitals. We're issuing clinical guidance. So on the at our level, you know, we're surveilling and taking care of trying to contain, you know, the cases that we have. But on the individual's level, we really want their support just by continuing to employ consistent hand hygiene practices.
Dr. Ezike, we're speaking with Dr. Ngozi Ezike, who's the new director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, and Dr. Rachel Rubin, who's a senior medical officer with Cook County's Department of Public Health. This is our first conversation with you as the new head of IDPH, and I don't want to have you leave without asking you about your priorities now that you're the chief officer for public health in Illinois.
Right. So I just want to, for sure, continue so much of the great work that's done in the department. We have so many programs, over 200 programs that are just the breadth is so extensive. We want to continue doing that great work, and we also, of course, want to focus on, you know, disparities and health equity. We've identified some some issues. You know, we had the maternal mortality report that came out October of last year, and so that has opened up the door to a lot of questions and a lot of issues that we want to address, specifically in terms of how certain people, certain groups, particularly people of color, have different outcomes when around their pregnancies and deliveries. So we're definitely going to focus on how we can close some of those gaps. So that's definitely a priority. And then also we have to get a handle on these vaccine-preventable diseases and trying to keep that at bay and figuring out what strategies would be best to close that down. We have an amazing, you know, invention of modern science in the form of vaccines, and I think we did so well with that we might have taken our foot off the gas, and people have forgotten that these diseases exist because the vaccines were so effective. And so now, with decreased vaccine rates, they're kind of making a comeback. So we really want to get on that as well.
Dr. Ezeke, we're almost out of time, but I just want to ask you about, as you think about this coming summer, what you want Illinoisans to be prepared for when we're thinking about our public health?
Right. So there's so much. You know, we are doing our part at the state level. You know, we're regulating the pools that people are going to be enjoying. We're always keeping up with our emergency prepared response. We want people to obviously maintain their schedules for their immunizations, both for children and for adults. We want people, as always, to maintain appropriate hand hygiene. We also would, of course, recommend that we wear seat belts, you know, that we are safe with safety measures. Like I said, seat belts, avoiding driving and with texting. So all these things that we try to put out, the community outreach messages all the time, we just want people to try to keep themselves as safe and healthy as possible.
Well, we'll have to have you come back to talk a little bit more about that. But I want to thank Dr. Ngozi Ezeke, the new director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Dr. Rachel Rubin is a senior medical officer with Cook County's Department of Public Health. Both of you, thank you for being with me.
Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks for having us.
Support for WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting the School of Art and Design Master of Fine Arts exhibition, on view now through April 25th. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you think back to your civics lessons, you might probably remember how a bill becomes a law, or at least a simple version of it. A lawmaker proposes one, it gets approved, and the chief executive, whether that's our president or governor, signs it into law. But who actually writes these laws? Well, it's not actually always lawmakers or legislative staff. Sometimes it's special interest groups that write bills themselves and then copy those bills word for word to other state legislatures. Reporters with the Arizona Republic, USA Today, and the Center for Public Integrity have been looking at how this happens. Over the past 8 years, they found that more than 10,000 of these so-called copycat bills were introduced in state houses across the country. About a fifth of those have become law. And in Illinois, we've passed more of these model bills into law than any other state. I'm joined now by two of the reporters behind this investigation. Rob O'Dell is an investigative and data reporter with the Arizona Republic. He's joining us from Phoenix. On the line from Denver is Nick Penzensadler, a reporter with USA Today's investigative team. Rob, Nick, welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Happy to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Rob, I wonder if we can just start with this whole idea of a model bill. Can you give us a simple definition of what that is?
Yeah, pretty simply, it's a bill that's written by someone who's not at the legislature, and it is often for a special interest, but not always. And then it's a bill that's it's sort of a fill-in-the-blank bill, a copycat bill, where you say, in this state, and you leave a blank for the state, and you leave blanks for a couple different areas that people can fill in, but the rest of the bill is mainly written so you can export it very quickly from state to state.
So not to be trite, but I was actually thinking of Mad Libs when I was reading your story. It's kind of a little bit like a fill in the blank there, right?
Yeah, and it has been described as legislative Mad Libs. It's interesting that you bring that up. In that you're simply filling in the words to make it, instead of making something different like you do in Mad Libs, this is to make it the same but just in a different state.
When we say special interests, what do we mean by that? Nick, who is writing all of these model bills?
Yeah, I mean, there are kind of the frequent flyers you may have heard of, like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALICE, their liberal counterpart. There's also the Goldwater Institute, but it's kind of a degrees of separation where an industry group may, like an insurance group may join an organization, and then that organization of national insurance groups will put forward these pieces of legislation that will try to flatten all these states so that they have the same standards and the same rules that may be, you know, in favor of one specific industry, in that case, like the insurance industry.
So one of the things that was most surprising to me when I was reading you guys' reporting was how oftentimes most lawmakers don't actually read the bill, even if they're a sponsor of it. Nick, can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think it's kind of varying degrees of participation from legislators, whether they're deeply involved in drafting and knowing the nitty-gritty details, or if it's more of a technical bill. We found a lot of times they've kind of passed that duty off to either their staff or, in some cases, whoever's writing the bill, and they trust, you know, they put their trust in the organizations pushing the model, and they say, you know, these are the experts. I don't need to know all of the deep details. You know, I wrote about asbestos and about some of these efforts to reduce litigation around the country, either in that realm or in personal injury, and it's sometimes, you know, really dizzying legal language, and they don't really want to know all of it, but they know they want to join other states or other either conservative or liberal-leaning efforts to make them the same.
Mm-hmm. That's the Asbestos Transparency Act. We're going to get to that in a minute. But Rob, can you just explain, so there was you and a team of reporters from USA Today, the Arizona Republic, and the Center for Public Integrity. You guys spent 2 years looking at this across the country. Can you explain a little bit about what you did and how you did it?
Yeah, well, the first thing we did was we took in all of the bills around the country from all 50 legislatures and Congress from 2010 to 2018, and then we built a database of known model bills, which we found by, you know, looking on the internet, talking to lobbyists, finding bills that we knew were models and going and finding them. And so we built a list of more than 2,000, and what we did was we compared that list of 2,000 models to the million bills that had been introduced in all 50 states. And we did that by comparing similar text strings. So we compared the text from the models to the bills that were introduced. And then we wrote an algorithm that scored how similar they were based on how long the strings of text were that were copied and then how many of them there were.
So kind of like if you were like looking for plagiarism, in other words, right? Like that's what it sounds like the way you're describing it.
Yeah, it is similar to that. It's a little bit different, but the concept is the same. We're looking for words that have been copied from this model in this legislation.
And so how many bills did you analyze, Rob?
More than a million, or almost a million, from 2010 through 2018, and compared that against those 2,000 models. And what we found was 10,000 bills around the country that were substantially copied from model legislation. It wasn't that like they borrowed a little bit. The main thrust of the legislation was substantially copied from a model.
And Rob, is this something new? Is this a new phenomenon, or has this existed, been part of just sort of how we've created laws in this country for a long time?
I think it's an old subject that people sort of always knew was going on. I think that's been what's sort of interesting about the reaction to our story is that's what everyone says. People are like, I sort of knew this was going on, but no one was ever really able to put their finger on it nationally, the extent. And I think that that's what's new about our coverage is the extent to which this is happening in every single state, and basically being able to say, here are a bunch of models that have been shopped around. So it's an older concept, but what we've been able to do now is sort of detail for the first time nationally how how much it's going on.
That's Rob O'Dell. He's an investigative and data reporter with the Arizona Republic. We're also talking to Nick Penzenstadler. He's a reporter with USA Today's investigative team. And we're talking about this whole idea of model or copycat bills. So, Nick, I wonder if we could get into some of the specifics here of why this is a problem. Before we get to the why this is a problem, I wonder what the incentives are for lawmakers to go along with this. Is it really just a matter of work, or as you said, sometimes these are complex legal issues and the work is basically done for you if you have a special interest group that's already done their research and written it?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. And part of our project surveyed legislators and asked them, you know, did you know this was a model? And did you agree with, you know, the merits of it, or was it more you wanted to join other causes that were like this? And we found a big mix, and we also found people who insisted that they wrote their own bill when we had proof that they didn't. So the motives, I think, are mixed between part-time legislators who don't have time to research and write a completely unique bill, to people who are or genuinely fully aware of the national effort behind some of these bills, and they want to join them, and they want to either boost some of their credentials and make it look like they're behind some of these efforts, or they just want to be like other states, and or it could be just good policy. I think that's important to remember, is that it's not always viewed in a negative light. If someone thinks there's a great idea in Florida that they'd like to bring to Illinois, they often say, why reinvent the wheel? Why would I spend all this time drafting new language when I could just borrow it? I think we see the problem when there is no transparency. Oftentimes people don't know who's writing these laws. So there is an industry group, like in my example of the insurance group, you know, writing laws in favor of specific organizations or industries, and they're behind it. So it's almost a form of kind of quiet lobbying behind the scenes to get their laws passed.
I wonder, Rob, what are some examples of how Illinois has done this? Have we seen, what do we know here in Illinois about model bills that became law?
Well, particularly model bills that became law, we've followed came to Arizona. Arizona's one of the centers of this, but of the charter school mission promote charter schools. And one of the bills that we see that passed in Illinois was the law that set up charter schools in Illinois, and we found that that was based on model legislation that was from the National Alliance for Public Schools, for public charter schools, excuse me. So that's one of the examples. I'm also looking at, just a smaller example is a resolution that was from the American Legislative Exchange Council that urged President Obama to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. And there's tons more, often having to do with healthcare or school choice.
Okay. And Rob, do we know, when we're thinking about, you guys did analysis, are they mainly industry sponsored? Are they written by liberal special interest groups, conservative?
It's both. And interestingly enough, actually it's all three, right? So Illinois has all three, conservative, industry, and liberal. And one of the things that's interesting about Illinois is that Illinois is one of the only states that shows up in the top 10 in both conservative bills and liberal bills. And I sort of ascribe that to you have a Democratic legislature with a supermajority, but then you also have very rural Republican districts that are probably really safe districts. And that's where you see more of the conservative bills coming from, more conservative districts, where the seats are more safe. And so that's what we see in Illinois. We see a large proportion of conservative bills, but also a large proportion of liberal bills. And that's the only state in the country where we see both of those in the same place.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense when you look at our political makeup. Nick, can we talk a little bit about how this could be damaging? And I'm thinking about ways that you've seen this hurt everyday residents? I mean, obviously, when we're thinking about just this whole idea, it's not always bad. Most of the time, being a state legislator is even a part-time job, and there are a lot of bills out there. But I wonder if we could get to one of the bills you all highlighted was, we talked about this before, the Asbestos Transparency Act. Can you tell us about that bill?
Right. So this was an effort backed by insurance companies to change the rules about how you go about filing an asbestos claim. So if you have mesothelioma, you only have a few months to live. So you're going to try to recover, you know, funds from someone who produced these products. And states have set up these trusts. And so you can either file a claim with a trust, or you can go after individual companies that might still exist and be able to pay you out. So the companies have said, and the insurance companies that hold all this, risk, say, we'd like you to go to the trust first, and we'd like you to make sure we show juries all the other companies that were involved. And they've added, you know, hurdle after hurdle from the victim's perspective before you can get a payout. So it's billed as the Trust Transparency Act, as a good thing, a good government piece of legislation. But there's a lot more kind of behind the scenes happening, where the average person that we talk to isn't so happy that they're adding these burdens, and they see hurdles before they can get a payout.
Rob, how much transparency is there around all of this? When we're due lawmakers, and I wonder, you know, you were talking about, you alluded to this before, do the lawmakers voting on bills know that they're voting on a model bill? It sounds like no, and especially if there's some lawmakers who insist they're writing it, even though you guys have proof that they didn't.
I think the answer is it depends on who it is, obviously. But we found a couple of broad trends. There's about half of the people that we interviewed who said, yeah, it's a model bill. I know it's from ALEC, and I don't see anything wrong with that. We had about another 40% of people who said, of legislators who said, they knew it was from another source, but they couldn't identify where, or they sort of insisted that they had written part of the bill, even though they had gotten the bill from somewhere else. And then there was, like, as Nick said before, there were a couple people who insisted that the bill was theirs. Interestingly enough, the person who had sponsored the most model legislation across the U.S., a representative from the Philadelphia suburbs in Pennsylvania, he had said, I had no idea that any of these were model bills, because he had signed on as a co-sponsor and said he had just signed on to other people's bills, and he didn't know that he was signing on to what was written, you know, essentially a model bill, a copycat bill. And so that sort of raises a question. If you're the legislators that you send to your state capitol don't know that it's a model bill, how are you as a member of the public supposed to know?
And I mean, as we end here, Rob, we just have a minute or two left. I think the story might confirm a lot of assumptions people have about how government works. And I wonder what you're hoping people take away from the investigations that you guys have done.
Well, I think the first thing that we want to get out there is that this is happening to this degree, and sort of this transparency of showing people, you know, this is where your laws are coming from. And then hopefully what we can do is we are continuing this project. So we are continuing to get model bills. We have a place where you can submit them to us, and we are continuing to run our system that compares them, and we're doing that almost in real time. So the hope is that we can continue to show this phenomenon where it shows up in all different state houses, and show the degree that special interests are behind some of the laws that we write, that are written for us.
So we'll tweet out that link for people who are interested, Rob. But so you're actually asking members of the public, concerned citizens, to help you guys with this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because a lot of these groups don't make their models public. So unless we have, in some case, and we don't have, USA Today Network doesn't have everyone in all 50 states, so nobody's going to know their own state house like the people that live there, right? So if there's model bills, or conversely, if there's bills that you think were generated from models, we can look at those too.
All right. Well, we will have that information. We'll tweet it out. We'll also have it up at 21stshow.org, and we'll tweet out the reporting that Nick and Rob and the rest of the team from the Arizona Republic, USA Today, and the Center for Public Integrity did. But I want to thank Rob O'Dell for being with us and Nick Pensen-Sadler for being with us as well. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about a new rule at Purdue University when it comes to streaming in the college classroom. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's Monday morning. It's time to sit down and get some work done. It'd be hard to do that when your phone is buzzing with texts, Instagram updates, Game of Thrones premiere reactions, you're listening to this public radio program. These days, our technology grabs our attention practically at every moment. Perhaps no one is more aware of that than college students and professors trying to get their attention in class. Now, Purdue University in Indiana is limiting streaming services like Netflix and Pandora during classes to leave more physical and mental bandwidth for academics. Mark Schoenstein is on the line with us now. He's the Executive Director of IT Infrastructure Services at Purdue. Mark, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you explain, first of all, what you guys are actually doing now with streaming and thinking about bandwidth for streaming services?
Sure. So we're blocking some specific sites that are non-academically focused, such as Hulu or Netflix, in order to free up bandwidth, wireless bandwidth, for services that the students need to reach, like Blackboard or Banner, our learning management systems.
Why did you guys decide to do this, Mark?
So the biggest problem is the wireless network is a shared resource, and so students in large classrooms primarily, when one or two students is streaming a video or something like that, they're consuming all of the resources available for all the other students in the classroom.
Right. So, when we think about the way we use technology, how much that's changed dramatically, thinking about multiple devices, and I imagine on a campus like Purdue, there are people sort of constantly demanding speed from the internet. I wonder what sort of physical changes your campus has had to make to accommodate all of the demand for streaming, Mark.
Yes, so we've increased the bandwidth available to students year over year. We've also added additional access points, but at some point it gets to where we can't even add any more wireless access points because the radios that they use start to interfere with each other and we get a negative response.
And are you guys at that point now?
We have deployed the density of access points that we can in most of the places. And we just can't keep up with the bandwidth requirements.
And Mark, what kind of feedback have you gotten from, has the change happened? I know you all announced it. Has it actually happened?
Yes, we are filtering streaming services across all academic spaces right now.
And is that only during classroom hours or is that at all times?
It's only during classroom hours. And it doesn't affect nights or weekends.
Okay. And what kind of feedback have you heard from, let's start with students. I wonder if you've had a different reaction from students than you have from faculty?
The interesting thing is we really haven't gotten a whole lot of pushback from the students. We did get a few angry emails at the beginning, but most of the feedback we've gotten has been around people asking for exceptions and things like that.
Okay. And what are you hearing from faculty?
Not a whole lot from faculty. During the proof of concept period, when we were testing everything out, we did get feedback from faculty asking how the program could be expanded into their classroom spaces and things like that. But generally, the only communications that we've really received from faculty is asking for specific exceptions for time periods when they want to use those services for class.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And we're speaking with Mark Schoenstein, the Executive Director of IT Infrastructure Services at Purdue. Mark, I know you have to go. Can you stick around for a minute or two? You need to head out pretty quickly here, right?
No, I can give you just a couple more minutes.
Okay. I want to introduce another guest, too. Alejandro Yeras is with us. He's a psychology professor at the U of I who studies attention at the university's Beckman Institute. Hi, Alejandro. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So I wonder what your reaction is to, as someone who studies attention, particularly when it comes to technology and devices, what you think about what Purdue has just implemented here.
Well, I think it's terrific. And I want to emphasize that I teach large undergraduate classes here at Illinois. And when a student is engaged in streaming Netflix or a show like that, not only is that student being distracted, but a lot of other students sitting around that person get distracted too. And I see that a lot. And we've had to make efforts in our classes to tell students, please don't do these things. Don't engage in these activities during our classes. Because if you think that you're the only one being affected, that's not true. If you look around, these images, these streaming shows are very engaging. If you're sitting two rows behind and you see flashes of light or something coming up or a steamy scene or whatever, it just grabs your attention and disconnects you from the class. So it's not only the person streaming that is being affected. Mm-hmm. And it changes, therefore, the overall atmosphere in the class.
How does it work at the University of Illinois, Alejandro? Is there a policy on devices in the classroom? Are there specific, is it up to the individual professor to make a rule?
Yeah, there are no official university guidelines on this, and I wish there was some effort on that. I think that when I talk to other professors around the university, we all say things like, oh, I wish you could just completely block all wireless
signal. Do
what
Purdue is doing, in other words.
Yes, and sometimes even more intensely. But I think that it's terrific. It's a great place to start. And if I were to go one step further, I would also recommend banning social media apps during class time. It's very disruptive, and there's a lot of kids doing that. And it's very distracting.
Mark, did you guys think about that at Purdue in terms of social media sites? Or are you really just, I wonder what the discussion was around what you were going to block.
So, again, our focus really was on making sure that wireless bandwidth was available for students to do academically focused things. We did have discussions around if other products or services needed to be blocked, such as social media, in order to engage, get the students to engage more in the classroom and focus on the class. We've left that up to the individual professors, and if the faculty come back to us and say, you know, we need you to block this service, we have the ability to do all of those things. But really, from our standpoint, it was a technology focus to limit the available bandwidth for non-academic purposes.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, I wonder, have you heard from other universities since you guys have implemented this?
So across the Big Ten, we regularly speak, and my peers across the Big Ten are very interested in getting feedback on what we've seen and how it's been implemented and how it's been received by the students.
All right. So,
and we have a meeting next month to discuss all of that.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. Mark Schoenstein is the Executive Director of IT Infrastructure Services at Purdue University. Mark, thank you for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks. Alejandro, now to kind of play the devil's advocate here, I wonder, and we were having a discussion with some of the student workers who work on the 21st and talking to them about this, and there was a perspective that was offered that if you were in university and you were paying for your classes, and if you don't want to pay attention, isn't that your choice? You're an adult.
Yeah, but I as already sort of hinted at, some of these behaviors are not just disruptive to the individual. I mean, they're definitely not paying attention if they're watching their favorite series on Netflix while they're in class. But I've seen it, and if you talk to the professors, they will tell you that this sort of activity is disrupting to the people around, and it's sort of like a reverberation effect. So you have a person streaming through Facebook, and every now and then there's like a video that starts up with something funny. Well, you know, the people around it, the people behind are going to do that, are going to look at it. Then that also encourages other people to feel free and to, well, you know, if
it kind of creates an atmosphere where no one feels like they have to pay attention.
Yes, and you feel it, particularly in classrooms that are large. You can feel that attention dissipates the farther you're away, they're away from you, because they feel like it's less likely that you're going to walk around them and look at them, look at what it's on their screen.
And so I wonder how you handle this when you're thinking about large classrooms. I imagine you teach some very large undergraduate classrooms. How does that, I mean, I wonder how you think the way we use technology has changed in the classroom for you and for students, especially when we're thinking about big lecture halls.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that technology has brought a lot of advances to the classroom that I think have been very positive. For example, in our classes, we use iClickers, which are a great way to integrate students and make them participate in class. You ask questions, and with these devices, they can respond to questions.
It's kind of like instant polls, and then they can respond.
Exactly, instant poll tools. And that's very engaging. You can make, you can sort of bring about a little discussion aspect to your lecture, even though it might be 200 people attending, by discussing, oh, look, 20% of you think this, etc. You can also then direct the results to the students, saying, what do you think that people respond in this way or that way? So it's a very good way to engage students. I also think that the arrival of laptops into classrooms can be very advantageous particularly for people who have learning disabilities or attentional disabilities, because you can provide students slides that are like mostly complete, and they just have to add their own notes to them. So it's a great help with note-taking. So there's a lot of positive things going that technology has provided, but there's also this other aspect, which is the distraction aspect.
And that's your research, and we've talked to you about this in the past. I wonder how you think these sites, whether it's social media or streaming, are kind of designed to maybe just kind of hook you in. You've talked about this on the past, about if we almost want to think of it in an addictive sort of way.
Yes, and I think that when we talk about streaming websites, I think of today as the golden age of storytelling. I don't think there's ever been as many stories told so beautifully, so well, all the time. And if you think as a professor that you can compete with the latest episode of Game of Thrones, well, you can't.
Right.
So I think that you might think as a student, well, I'll be able to pay attention to this show or to this game that is going on, or stream or look at my Facebook feed while the professor is saying something that is uninteresting or that I already understood. But what people are very bad at understanding is that our attention-grabbing stories, that they've been designed to keep your eyes on them, both the stories or your Facebook feeds. So once you orient your attention to them, it's going to be much harder for you to disengage. And then when you do disengage, then you're lost, because you didn't follow to the new topic of the conversation.
Well, and also when we're thinking about streaming, right, everything's designed for binge watching. So even if you think to yourself, I'm just going to watch one episode, if you don't turn it on in 4 seconds, the next episode has started, and you're kind of like, oh, I'm sucked back in.
Yes. They think a lot about this company. They spend a lot of money and time trying to maximize viewing time and attention. That's how they make their money.
And so with that said, I wonder if there are any final thoughts you think about how much, even I wonder, the idea of not just technology in the classroom, but for people who are not in the classroom, thinking about how distracted we are, like what the takeaways are for not just students, but adults.
Well, I think that we are arriving at a moment in time where we are more and more distracted, and we have less and less time to focus on our own thoughts, on our own feelings, on our own problems. And distraction is a very good short-term strategy to not handle our problems emotionally or our problems in real life. So that has a consequence. Long-term psychological research has shown that if the way you deal with stress and anxiety in your life is by just distracting yourself, over the long term, that tends to lead to mental health problems. If you have an emotional problem with your mom or a loved one, if you spend some time thinking about it or trying to act on it and solve that problem, well, you're going to alleviate a much longer period of time where that anxiety keeps coming at you, right? So we think that we like to be distracted, and it does provide us with some short-term comfort because those distractions are great. But on the long term, a distraction as a way of regulating your problems and your emotions is not a very good strategy.
That's Alejandro Lleras. He teaches psychology at the University of Illinois, and he also works at the Beckman Institute. Alejandro, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That does it for us today. That's all the time we have. Tomorrow, you might think that your genes are fixed at birth and then pass that on to the next generation. But it actually turns out your life experiences can actually become embedded in your genes, particularly if you're experiencing poverty. Researchers at Northwestern have found that poverty leaves a mark on up to 10% of the human genome. We'll talk about that tomorrow. You can head to 21stshow.org for more information about us. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. See you back here tomorrow. Thank you for listening.